Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 21st, 2014 edition of The Week magazine. The main stories and how they were covered. Delaying the Obamacare business mandate again. The White House this week announced another delay to the Affordable Care Act's employer mandate, sparking angry accusations from Republicans that President Obama was unilaterally and illegally rewriting his signature health care law. The delay gives medium-sized businesses with 50 to 99 workers until 2016 to provide their employees with health coverage or pay a penalty of more than $2,000 per employee. Just a few months ago, the administration moved that deadline back from 2014 to 2015. Under the new rules, companies with 100 workers or more will still have to meet their 2015 deadline, but for 1 year will have a softer coverage target of 70% of employees rather than the 95% stipulated under Obamacare. President Obama said the delay will give smaller companies that are making a good faith effort to conform with the law more time to adjust. "Our goal here is not to punish folks," Obama said. Republicans accused Obama of violating the Constitution and of unfairly favoring businesses over individuals, who still face penalties if they don't have health insurance by March 31st. Once again, the president is giving a break to corporations while individuals and families are still stuck under the mandates of his health care law, said House Speaker John Boehner. And, once again, the president is rewriting law on a whim. What the editorials say. Another day, another lawless exemption, said the Wall Street Journal. The employer mandate was supposed to be central to Obamacare's claim of universal coverage. When businesses protested, saying it would force them to cut back on hiring and to shift workers to part-time roles, liberals insisted such arguments were false, if not beneath contempt. Now the White House has decided to listen to businesses, out of fear of a politically damaging backlash before this year's midterm elections. The employer mandate move is merely the latest in a long list of unilateral changes Obama has made, said the Washington Examiner. It's now abundantly clear that Obamacare is not actually a law, but really just whatever Obama makes of it. The Republican reaction to the delay was predictably over the top, said the Washington Post. Studies show that the employer mandate isn't even key to insuring more people. Medium-sized businesses of 50 to 99 employees constitute just 7% of the private workforce. And 91% of businesses with between 50 and 199 workers already offered their employees insurance coverage in 2013 anyway. Still, the fact that Republicans won't cooperate in fixing the law does not give the president authority to keep altering the original legislation. The president should implement the law. What the columnist said. The motivation for this latest delay is transparently political, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. By once again delaying the painful demands of this unwieldy and gargantuan edifice, Obama hopes to save some faltering red state incumbents facing re-election in November from defeat. But no amount of lawless royalism on Obama's part could make this law work, said John Podhoretz in New York Post. The administration had almost 4 years to get its ducks in a row, yet Obama still spent the past 6 months rewriting the law for both political and practical reasons. Face it, liberals, because it's now obvious to everyone, this law is a lemon. Republicans have done everything they can think of to destroy Obamacare, said Sam Baker in NationalJournal.com. But the White House is the one consistently doing the real damage. With each delay, Obama plays into the Republican narrative that the law is too complex and unwieldy. But despite those self-inflicted wounds, the real story is that Obamacare is moving forward. Hundreds of thousands of people continue to sign up on the exchanges, insurance premiums are lower than expected, and the law's basic survival is assured. Still, Democrats may come to regret Obama's accelerating domestic imperialism, said Charles C.W. Cook in NationalReview.com. While they're currently cheering this president's pick-and-choose method of implementing federal law, they'll be horrified when the shoe is on the other foot. Someday there will be another Republican president, and thanks to Obama's precedent, he too will be able to ignore or amend laws on personal whim. And our second main story, U.S. will wait Karzai out. In a sign of the Obama administration's growing frustration with Hamid Karzai, U.S. officials this week revealed that they would wait until the Afghan president leaves office this spring to complete a long-delayed security pact that will decide how many, if any, American troops remain in the country beyond 2014. The U.S. wants to leave 10,000 troops in the country to take part in counterterrorism operations and train Afghan forces after NATO's mission ends in December. But Karzai has repeatedly declined to sign a deal authorizing a foreign troop presence. Tired of the president's antagonistic behavior, he has recently taken part in secret negotiations with the Taliban and accused U.S. troops of war crimes. American officials said they would conclude the agreement with Karzai's successor, to be chosen in national elections this April. This mess perfectly sums up the futility of our Afghanistan mission, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. We've spent about $700 billion and sacrificed more than 2,000 American lives over the past decade, propping up Karzai's regime. Yet the country remains corrupt and violence-prone, and its leader sounds as hostile and extreme as our Taliban enemies. Instead of hoping that Karzai's successor will be any better, we should simply acknowledge that there are some things the world's sole superpower can't do, and fixing Afghanistan is one of them. Karzai's behavior is frustrating, but rational, said Peter Thompson in Politico.com. While he's not running in April's presidential election, he does seem to be maneuvering for future relevance. Bashing America is one way to boost his standing with Islamist militants and ordinary Afghans tired of war. Allowing Karzai to position himself as a future bridge between the Taliban and the next Afghan government. Whatever game Karzai is playing, the U.S. can't walk away from Afghanistan, said the Baltimore Sun in an editorial. Without our support, Afghan government forces would lose much of the country to the Taliban, and terrorist training camps would again dot Afghanistan, just as they did before 9/11. That leaves the Obama administration with no choice but to sit tight and hope that Karzai's eventual successor proves more adept at holding up the Afghans' end of the bargain. The controversy of the week. The Sochi Games. A disaster for Putin? Vladimir Putin wanted the Sochi Winter Olympics to be a showcase of modern Russia, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. He has succeeded, though not as he intended. Hosting the Games will cost cash-strapped Russia $51 billion, more than every previous Winter Olympics combined. But you wouldn't know it from Putin's Potemkin version of a world-class Olympic venue. Packs of emaciated stray dogs roam the streets of Sochi. Undrinkable brown tap water dribbles out of hotel faucets. Skiers and snowboarders are fuming over the poorly engineered courses and the 63-degree temperatures that have left the man-made snow mushy and dangerous. During the historic opening ceremony, an electronic malfunction produced 4 instead of 5 Olympic rings. "What an embarrassment," said Jackson Deal in WashingtonPost.com. The preening Putin wanted to use the Sochi Games to reintroduce the world to a confident, economically booming power whose influence in Eastern Europe and the Middle East is coming back. Instead, the Olympics have served to shine a spotlight on Russia's corruption, medieval new anti-gay laws, and the ever-present threat of terrorism from the Caucasus region he has so brutally repressed. Whichever nation skis and slides and twirls its way to the most medals in these games, Putin and Russia have already lost. "There's something mean-spirited in all this Olympics schadenfreude," said Julia Ioff in The New Republic. Western journalists act as if every lukewarm shower or broken bathroom door were further proof of the hilarious dysfunction at the heart of the new Russia. "Look at these stupid savages. They can't do anything right," we gloat, forgetting the litany of problems that have plagued every Olympiad of the modern era. Remember the bomb that injured over 100 people in the Atlanta Games in 1996? Said Joe Concha in thedailybeast.com. How about the terrorist massacre of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Berlin Games? Despite some minor glitches, the Sochi Games have been captivating, compelling, and visually stunning. "Nonetheless, Sochi is a vanity project," said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Like other dictators before him, Russia's new czar seized on the Olympics as a propaganda tool. Their ultimate purpose is to distract the Russian public from the country's economic dysfunction, dropping life expectancy, and political repression. Even Putin's perverse decision to stage the games in Sochi, a subtropical beach resort that's his favorite getaway, was an act of enormous self-indulgence. If authoritarian egotism were an Olympic event, Putin would win the gold medal going away. He may yet regret staging these games, said Louise Branson in USA Today. The Olympics have a way of laying bare political realities, particularly in dictatorial societies. The failure of the 1980 Moscow Games, which dozens of nations boycotted over the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, sent shockwaves through Soviet society, as citizens saw their government in a new, unflattering light. It was one of the defining moments that helped push the Soviet Union to its collapse a decade later. Among Russians, Putin's biggest asset was always his strongman image, said Anshul Pfeffer in Haaretz.com. The worldwide chorus of mockery and criticism, which has reached Russians through the Internet, has already cracked that image. If one day Russians find the strength and courage to evict their cheesy, bare-chested parody of a ruler from the Kremlin, the seeds will have been sown in Sochi. It was a good week for going stag. After the White House tore up its original invitations to a state dinner honoring philandering French President François Hollande to omit his recently dumped romantic partner, and seated Hollande between President Obama and his wife Michelle. It was a good week for copying Adam and Eve. After a Virginia evangelical church began offering nude church services, claiming that foregoing clothes was in line with Jesus' anti-materialist message. "If God made us that way," said Pastor Alan Parker, How can that be wrong? It was a good week for looking up after scientists revealed that species of crocodiles found in Florida, Mississippi, and Africa are capable of climbing trees. One Nile crocodile was spotted on a branch 13 feet high. It was a bad week for happy feet. After a colony of South American penguins at a British zoo was prescribed antidepressants to help them cope with the torrential rains that have battered the country for weeks. They are thoroughly fed up and miserable, said a spokesperson. It was a bad week for casual racism. After a Los Angeles news anchor asked Samuel L. Jackson about his recent Super Bowl TV commercial, an ad that had actually starred Lawrence Fishburne. We may all be black and famous, Jackson shot back, but we don't all look alike. And it was a bad week for torture. After Canadian metal band Skinny Puppy billed the U.S. government $666,000 for allegedly using their dark, frantic music to torment Guantanamo detainees. Our music is unsettling for some, to say the least, said the band's singer. Put into the wrong environment, it could be your biggest nightmare. While we're on this page, a boring but important note. Congress signs off on debt ceiling increase. The House of Representatives and the Senate approved a one-year extension of the government's borrowing authority this week, with no strings attached, after Republican leaders backed away from another potentially damaging battle over the debt limit. In a narrow 221 to 201 vote, 28 House Republicans joined all but two Democrats to suspend the debt ceiling for more than a year, marking a retreat from GOP House Speaker John Boehner's longstanding principle of attempting to offset any increase in the debt ceiling with spending cuts of an equal size. The bill, which President Obama was expected to sign soon, eliminates any chance of a default on the government's $17.2 trillion debt until March of 2015. On the briefing page this week, the evolution of the NSA. Born in the Cold War, the National Security Agency was transformed by 9/11. Has it grown too large? What is the NSA's mission? The National Security Agency is the U.S. government's primary eavesdropping agency. It intercepts, decodes, and analyzes foreign communications, such as emails, telephone calls, and other signals intelligence. The Fort Meade, Maryland-based agency, which has an annual budget of about $10 billion and employs some 40,000 people, has long carried out this mission in the shadows. But a series of leaks by former agency contractor Edward Snowden has revealed the stunning scale of its global surveillance operation. It's now known that the NSA scoops up and stores billions of internet communications and cell phone records from the U.S. and around the world every day, which can then be studied by the agency's legion of codebreakers, data miners, and counterterrorism specialists. When President Obama receives his daily intelligence briefing, at least 75% comes from the NSA's cyber spies, said Mike McConnell, Director of National Intelligence under President George W. Bush. Why was the NSA created? It was set up by President Truman in 1952 to consolidate the military's jumble of code-breaking operations into a single, powerful agency capable of cracking the Soviet Union's communications. The NSA, whose existence remained classified for decades, quickly became the intelligence community's crown jewel. It ringed the USSR with 100-foot-tall, 1,000-foot-wide antennas that intercepted wireless signals as they bounced between the Earth and the ionosphere. It stationed spy ships in the seas and sent reconnaissance planes and satellites into the skies. Very quickly, the sheer volume of information harvested by the NSA dwarfed the human intelligence gathered by CIA agents in the field. The CIA is good at stealing a memo off a prime minister's desk, said one former NSA director. They're not much good at anything else. Were the NSA's intercepts useful? At times, enormously so. The NSA was the first agency to spot Soviet missiles in Cuba in 1962. It provided advanced warning of China's first nuclear bomb test in 1964. And its monitoring of Soviet Premier Leonid Brezhnev's limousine telephone gave American negotiators crucial inside information during arms limitation talks in 1972. But NSA intercepts also led to some colossal blunders. In August 1964, the agency reported that U.S. destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin had been attacked by North Vietnamese boats twice in 3 days. But the second attack, used by President Johnson to justify an escalation of U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, never occurred. The NSA had overheard North Vietnamese radio operators discussing the first battle and misinterpreted it as a live combat report. It was one of the greatest intelligence mistakes in history, said Matthew Aid, author of the NSA history, The Secret Sentry. Does the agency spy domestically? Yes, though these efforts are sometimes of dubious legality. From the 50s to the early 70s, the NSA operated a program called Shamrock that saw U.S. telegram companies hand over up to 150,000 messages a month, including many telegrams from ordinary Americans, which agency analysts studied for evidence of Soviet spying. Under President Johnson and Nixon, the NSA worked with the FBI and CIA to monitor the communications of civil rights leaders and anti-war protesters, including Martin Luther King Jr. and Jane Fonda, as well as members of Congress. The exposure of these programs by Idaho Senator Frank Church led Congress to enact the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in 1978, which created a secret court to hear warrant requests from intelligence services. How did 9/11 change the agency? The attacks forced the NSA to adapt to the digital age. After September 11, 2001, embarrassed the nation's intelligence community, NSA officials launched a massive effort to capture, store, and analyze emails, text, and online charts, chats, and videos used by terrorist networks. They took on a new mission that required sifting vast amounts of data to find a few important signals, said Stuart Baker, a former senior Homeland Security official. The NSA ordered America's largest telecom firms and internet service providers to hand over raw data as it transited their networks. It tapped directly into the fiber optic cables that constitute the internet's nervous system and recruited scores of Silicon Valley experts, including Max Kelly, Facebook's former chief security officer, to help it navigate the new digital landscape. How much data is collected? The agency says it touches 1.6% of all traffic being carried on the internet, about 29.2 petabytes of communication data a day. That's the equivalent of collecting all the text held in the Library of Congress 2,990 times every day. Intelligence officials argue that these intercepts have provided crucial insights into Iran's nuclear weapons program, aided the U.S. military's operations in Iraq and Libya, and helped disrupt dozens of potential terrorist attacks around the world. But some former employees claim the NSA's ability to collect data is now outpacing its ability to analyze it. Despite all this collection, the NSA missed the Boston bombing, the underwear bomber, and the Times Square bomber, said James Bamford, a historian of the NSA. The problem is the bigger you build the haystack, the harder it is to find the needle. The NSA's hard drive. The NSA has mastered the art of collecting vast amounts of communications data. It now has somewhere to store it. Last year, the agency opened a $1.7 billion data center in the Utah desert, which houses 100,000 square feet of high-performance servers. The computers use 65 megawatts of electricity, about the same as a small city, and generate so much heat that they require 1.5 million gallons of cooling water a day. William Binney, a former NSA technical director turned whistleblower, estimates that the warehouse's servers can handle 5 zettabytes of data, which would fill 1.25 trillion DVDs. That means the agency has enough storage to hold 100 years' worth of worldwide communications and emails, said Binney, and then have plenty of space left over to do any kind of parallel processing to try to break codes. We'll turn over now to the best columns of the U.S. First up, Impeaching Bill Clinton Again, by Brad Knickerbocker at csmonitor.com. Why does Rand Paul keep bringing up Monica Lewinsky? Said Brad Knickerbocker. In recent weeks, the Republican senator and possible 2016 presidential candidate has made repeated references on the sex scandal that nearly did end Bill Clinton, lo, those 16 years ago. On NBC's Meet the Press, Paul accused Clinton of predatory behavior for taking advantage of a girl that was 20 years old and an intern in his office. Days later, he connected the scandal to 2016 frontrunner Hillary Clinton, questioning why a supposed champion of women had such an unsavory character for a husband. Such nastiness can have only one explanation. Republicans know they're losing the war on women. The GOP's hostility to legal abortion, contraception, and equal pay laws has opened a wide gender gap. In a new CNN poll, 59% of all women and 64% of women over 50 say Republicans don't understand them. So with Hillary in a strong position to become the first female president, Paul is digging up old dirt. But as long as Republicans keep talking about women's libidos, trying to re-impeach Bill Clinton will do them little good. This one from Joseph Curl at the Washington Times. The Victims of Hoffman's Addiction. After the news of Philip Seymour Hoffman's death from a heroin overdose broke last week, everyone agreed it was sad and tragic, said Joseph Curl. What a shame, people said, that such a talented actor had to die so young, at 46, overcome by the disease of addiction. The implication, his relapse and death were not his fault. But do you know what's really sad? That he chose heroin not only over his work and his life, but over his three young children, ages 10, 7, and 5. When children lose a parent to addiction, psychologists say, they wonder why mom or dad loved the drug more than them, and question whether it was their inadequacy that caused this abandonment. Such psychic wounds are deep and lasting. Hoffman had the same chance as other addicts to beat back his personal demons and get help to regain sobriety. Millions have made this choice, but instead of cleaning himself up for his family, Hoffman went the other way, down in the darkness, and now his children must deal with the consequences. That's the real legacy Philip Seymour Hoffman left. From Charles Blow at the New York Times, The Myth of Obama's Dictatorship. Barack Obama is a lawless dictator hell-bent on subverting the Constitution and making himself a king. This is the latest meme from the Republican messaging machine, which is citing as evidence the president's recent pledge to use executive orders to advance his policy objectives when Congress refuses to act. We have an increasingly lawless presidency, Representative Paul Ryan charged last week. But is the basis for this superheated rhetoric true? In his 5 years in office, Obama has issued 168 executive orders. That's fewer than any two-term president in more than 100 years. George W. Bush issued 291 executive orders. In his two terms, Ronald Reagan issued 381 executive orders. Richard M. Nixon issued 346, and Harry S. Truman issued 907. So with Obama issuing less than half as many such orders as his predecessors, how does he qualify as a dictator? This lawlessness talk is simply another iteration of the othering of this president, in line with calling him a criminal and a foreigner. Republicans do not care if there is no evidence for their claims. Through the repetition of fallacy, they hope to make the truth irrelevant. And it must be true, I read it in the tabloids. A Kentucky woman allegedly bought a car just so she could ram it into the supermarket that she hates. Police said that June Ann Blocker intentionally smashed her newly purchased 2006 Lincoln through the front of a local Kroger, slightly injuring two people. The former Kroger employee appears to have a long-standing grievance with the store, having previously driven a car into another of its Elizabethtown shops in 1999. Despite Blocker's animosity toward the store, said family friend Jane Embry, she is a wonderful person. We'll take a look now at our in-depth article for the section called The Last Word. This week it's titled Left for Dead. Every day motorists kill pedestrians and drive away, said Neely Tucker. This is the story of one such death. Somewhere out there, perhaps even reading this, is the driver who hit and killed Tiara Nichelle Jackson. It was June 8th last year, closing in on 2 in the morning, on a flat and unremarkable stretch of the Beltway in Prince George's County, Maryland. Tiara was a 22-year-old mom, petite, pretty, outgoing. She had an eye-popping personality. You would like her, that's what everyone says. She lost control of her car on the outer loop as it passed the Ritchie Marlboro Road exit. She braked hard, but her blue Chrysler Sebring convertible slid against the barrier on the far side of the highway. It then spun across all four lanes into the grassy median, plowed into the steel barrier separating the inner and outer loops, and finally came to a stop. Tiara got out and went back to the roadway. Perhaps she was trying to flag down help. Instead, she was almost immediately struck by an oncoming vehicle. The driver did not stop. There were no skid marks before the point of impact and none after. The next driver who hit her did not stop either, nor did the next. This went on for perhaps 20 minutes. The Maryland State Police report says the initial vehicle's impact was so great and the lighting so poor that after the first driver or so, it is unlikely other motorists knew they were striking a human's remains. The story of that night is simple. It asks only a couple of questions. But first, consider. The Beltway is the aorta of regional traffic. It plays a universal role in the life of Washington, D.C. It measures our circumference, 64 miles. It defines the capital region for the rest of the nation. And if there is a most common experience to life here, it's taking the Beltway. From Potomac to Clinton, from Alexandria to Silver Spring, it is the one road upon which almost every resident eventually must travel, from the president to the proletariat. So were you to be traveling this roadway of our lives and suffer the same misfortune as Tiara Jackson, an accident, a flat tire, a leaking radiator, what stranger would stop to help? Would anyone? Should anyone? How quickly would you be dismissed as outside the bonds of human compassion and left upon an island of fatal indifference? Let's agree that the wreck is an archetype of American life. More than 5.6 million traffic accidents were reported to police in 2012. There were 33,561 fatalities, or about 92 deaths per day. About 4,600 pedestrians, Tiara Jackson would be listed as one, have been killed each year since 2002. Hit-and-run deaths, the kind we're talking about here, make up about 4% of all traffic fatalities from 1982 to 2011, with 1,394 in 2011. That's almost four per day. The Capitol Beltway had 101 traffic fatalities between 2007 and 2011, with 17 being non-occupants, such as pedestrians. So, somewhere in America, there are a couple of Tiara Jacksons every day, year in and year out. People get behind the wheel, they hit and kill somebody, and take off before they get caught. You have to wonder what that feels like. The last night of Tiara's life, Levi Martin, her stepdad, was at home. Kimberly Jackson Martin, her mom, was out helping a friend prepare for a baby shower. Tiara and her son Princeton, two, were in their room, the door closed, Levi thinking she was getting in a nap before her overnight shift. But it turns out Tiara was not going to work. She had quit her security dispatch job but hadn't worked up nerve to tell her parents. Levi says she stayed in her room with lights out all evening. Kimberly came home just before midnight. Thinking that Tiara had to be at work soon, she woke her up with a text message to avoid knocking on the door and risk waking the toddler. By 12:12 a.m., Tiara was texting her mom while getting dressed, making small talk, borrowing a few dollars for gas. Then Tiara went downstairs, walked out the front door, and got into the Sebring. She pulled out and left. What do we owe one another? What are the bonds among us all? More to the point, it's late at night. You're driving on the Beltway and you hit another human being. You killed her. Would you stop? You should, of course. It's the law. Every state says this. Maryland law compels drivers in collisions to remain at the scene. In an accident resulting in bodily injury or death, there is a duty to give information and render aid, according to the official police report on Tiara's death. You're even protected by Good Samaritan laws from ungrateful victims who try to sue you for helping them in ways they later don't appreciate. And in this case, Tiara was at fault. For whatever reason, dazed, concussed, frightened, she walked onto the fast lane of the Beltway. The police report says her death was a result of pedestrian error. A pedestrian may not walk along a controlled access highway. Had the driver stopped, he or she would have borne no legal responsibility, unless the driver were drunk, speeding, or both. But fleeing? Fleeing is not only a crime, it violates what it means to be human. Let's check in with Franz De Waal. One of the world's premier researchers into primate behavior, he has written many books, most recently, The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. He is unequivocal. The urge to help others in crisis is seen in primates, never mind humans. To ignore another human being in crisis, he points out, is not just inhuman, it goes against all mammalian behavior, which is roughly 200 million years old. Still, he says, it's not that hit-and-run drivers lack empathy. It's that they lack enough empathy to involve themselves in a life-altering event that is perhaps not of their making. And for strangers, you do less than you would for familiar people, he said. Empathy is biased. You'd think hit-and-run cases, as prevalent as they are, would attract a great deal of research, so we'd know more about the mentality involved, but this isn't so. When J. Thomas Dalby, a forensic psychologist at the University of Calgary, set out to review major studies of the field several years ago, the only one he found was from the 1940s. His findings, and those of other small studies, tell you what you might already guess. Most of these incidents happen at night or on weekends. Drivers who are apprehended often have alcohol in the bloodstream. They often have a history of traffic violations. There are no clear national statistics on how often hit-and-run drivers are caught and prosecuted. The most basic premise you can say is that these are successful criminals, said Dalby. Even if you panic and think, just after the impact, can I get away with this? The answer is that you probably can. These are not witnessed in a lot of cases. You're already in the getaway car, and your foot is on the gas. This is not a flattering thing to say about human beings, but there it is. None of Tiara's closest friends or family say they knew at the time, or have figured out since, where she was going that night. At 1:38, she was about 10 miles from her parents' house, northbound on the outer loop. She resumed a conversation she had left off earlier with her friend Matt Dancy. Making light of his note that meeting her before midnight was too early, she texted back, "You funny." Dancy's phone records show him replying within seconds, asking what she meant. When she didn't reply, he sent a follow-up message 2 minutes later, frustrated they had not gotten together. She texted back, also at 1:40, "Don't trip." At almost this precise instant, a 24-year-old government worker named Tanisha Williams and a friend were on the inner loop, approaching the same exit from the opposite direction. Williams was in the fast lane, the one closest to the median. She saw only one car on the outer loop. It was in the farthest slow lane, and it began to brake and drift to the right. Police would later measure Tiara's skid marks at 101 feet 5 inches before it hit the guardrail, scraping along the passenger side. Then Williams saw the car careen off the rail and hurtle directly toward her, an out-of-control missile. It came from the right lane all the way to the left, she recalls. It was spinning. It went down in the median. It hit the guardrail and bounced back and came up in the air like it was going to flip up in the air out onto my side of the road. She pulled to the far side of the road, at least half a mile past the wreck. Her friend got out and started back. Williams dialed 911. The call is stamped at 1:43, 3 minutes after Tiara's last text. A moment later, her friend got back into the car, saying the wreck was too far back. Williams remembers flooring it, pushing the car to 100 miles per hour. It was 2 miles to the Pennsylvania Avenue exit. She hit the ramp, crossed over, and came flying back, her heart thumping, wondering if she was about to jump out of the car and try to save somebody's life. The Sebring spun hard against the guardrail, shooting backward until it crashed into a support pole. The collision jutting the battered nose back toward the roadway. It was in shambles. An axle was bent, the frame was twisted. The trunk and the hood were busted open, wreckage scattered in the weeds. The passenger window had shattered, spraying bits of star-shaped shrapnel. But otherwise, the interior of the car was pristine. The windshield was not cracked, the airbags had not inflated, there was not a drop of blood. At this point, this was not a fatal accident. Tiara's parents were less than 15 minutes away. She did not know it, but Williams was almost within shouting distance. Pulled over on the opposite side of the road, calling police and paramedics, and in seconds, all of them would be rushing to Tiara's aid. But Tiara got out of the car shortly after 1:43 a.m. In the misting rain and the darkness, she walked or limped or crawled 30 feet toward the road, toward the light, toward someone she thought could help. Williams was too late. An ambulance and a police car had just arrived when she got back. She slowed, pulled past the wreck, and drove home, relieved that paramedics arrived so quickly. A few days after the wreck, after the body was identified, her mother got off the phone and told her something. "It turns out that girl, Tiara, was my cousin," Williams said. "I had not met her, and I sure didn't know who it was on that road that night, but it was my family. My family. And I might have driven by and left her out there." This was reprinted by permission from the Washington Post. An obituary for you this week. The child star who became a U.S. ambassador, Shirley Temple Black, 1928 to 2014. Shirley Temple had already become Hollywood's biggest box office draw when, at age 8, she got a first inkling of her fame. Hearing adoring admirers shouting out their love for her, I wondered why, she later said. I asked my mother and she said, "Because your films make them happy." By then, in fact, Temple had captured Depression-era America's heart, said Variety, becoming as big a star around the world as Greta Garbo and Charlie Chaplin. She received 135,000 birthday cards on her 11th birthday in 1939, when she was one of the nation's top wage earners. Her success saved her studio, 20th Century Fox, and the ubiquitous Shirley Temple dolls modeled on the dimpled blonde, curly-headed girl generated $45 million in sales before World War II. Born in Santa Monica, California, Temple was spotted by an agent as a 3-year-old in dance class and selected to star in a series of one-reel shorts called Baby Burlesque, said the New York Times. Her feature-length career began in 1934 with Stand Up and Cheer, one of the many films made during the Depression in which music chases away unhappy reality. That year alone, she made 8 films, including Little Miss Marker, in which she played a wise and maternal miniature adult who reforms a ragtag band of gamblers. She had a similar persona in Bright Eyes, 1934, The Little Colonel, 1935, and Wee Willie Winkie, 1937. She often sang, most famously on the good ship Lollipop, and danced, most successfully with tap dancer Bill Bojangles Robinson, becoming the first white actress allowed to hold hands affectionately with a black man on screen. Temple's film career faded as she became a teenager, said the Washington Post, and she escaped the tight control of her parents by marrying at age 17. That marriage soon ended in divorce, but at 21 she married California businessman Charles Black, who introduced her to the world of Republican politics. After an unsuccessful run for Congress, she was appointed a delegate to the United Nations by Richard Nixon in 1969. And her golfing buddy Gerald Ford named her ambassador to Ghana in 1974, then chief of protocol in 1976, appointed U.S. ambassador to Czechoslovakia in 1989, she succeeded beyond almost everyone's expectations. "Having been Shirley Temple provides name identification," she said, "but in diplomacy, it had little bearing on whether I succeed or fail thereafter." On the health and science page, recharting the flow of the maple's sap. For centuries, New England's maple syrup makers have worked on the principle that sap flows downward from the tops of mature maple trees. When the weather is right on a warm day following a below-freezing night, they tap a spot near the trunk's bottom to collect the vital fluid before boiling it down to syrup. But apparently they've had it wrong all along. University of Vermont researchers have discovered that sap actually flows up from the ground, an insight that could revolutionize the maple syrup industry. It had never occurred to anyone. It's just always been done this way, Vermont syrup maker Laura Sorkin tells NPR.org. Researchers made the discovery when a vacuum pump extracted far more sap than expected from an older maple tree that had lost its crown, and confirmed it with tests on saplings that had their tops lopped off. They've since concluded that rows of chest-high branchless saplings could produce 10 times more syrup per acre than a stand of mature maples does. Sorkin, for one, worries that the new approach could open syrup production to entrepreneurs anywhere. And on a more visceral level, she says, I feel that maple syrup is and should remain a product of the wild. On the Talking Points page, gay in the NFL, Michael Sam comes out. When the NFL opens the 2014 season, something will be different, said Ben Jacobs in thedailybeast.com. At least one player will be openly gay. With the NFL draft approaching, University of Missouri defensive end Michael Sam publicly revealed this week that he's gay, saying, I just want to own my truth. The SEC's reigning defensive player of the year, Sam came out to his teammates and coaches prior to the 2013 season, then led the Tigers to a 12-2 record and number 5 national ranking. Sam's historic announcement took real courage. In the hyper-macho world of the NFL, no current player has ever come out. And if he's drafted as expected, he will become the first openly gay player in a major American team sport. Sam has a real fight ahead of him, said Ta-Nehisi Coates in TheAtlantic.com. One unnamed NFL player personnel official said after Sam's announcement that the league isn't ready for an openly gay player, noting that gay slurs are commonplace in locker rooms and that it's still a man's man's game. In other words, quote, faggots don't play football, end quote. Like the first black and women soldiers and black baseball players, Sam will be playing not just for himself, but in some sense for his people. Predictably, some coaches and players have grumbled about showering in front of a gay player, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Straight dudes, relax. Chances are a gay guy has already seen you naked in a locker room without you knowing it. And he wasn't beaming special gay conversion gamma rays at you. It no longer matters whether the NFL is ready for a gay player, said Frieda Gittes in CNN.com. The country is in the midst of a fundamental social shift, with a majority of Americans now supporting equal rights for homosexuals and gay marriage. This acceptance has occurred with astonishing quickness and was unthinkable 15 years ago. Sam will break down yet another wall of prejudice as millions of fans see a hard-nosed, muscle-bound lineman who happens to be gay. On and off the field, Sam will be watched closely, said Juliet McCour in the New York Times, and he will have to work harder to prove his worth. But the reaction of the NFL, its players, and its fans will be judged too. It's time to move forward. And a few notes here. Nearly 80% of the Great Lakes is now frozen over. More ice cover than in any year since 1996. The ice on massive Lake Superior is so thick that 15,000 people have walked more than a mile to check out the ice caves at the Apostle Islands. More than 1,000 Iraqis were killed in car bombings, suicide bombings, and other terrorist attacks in January, including 795 civilians, 122 soldiers, and 96 policemen. It was the deadliest month in Iraq in nearly 6 years. More than half the prisoners in the U.S. have a mental health problem, including schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, according to the Justice Department. This country now houses three times the number of mentally ill people in jails as it does in mental hospitals. At a reported $51 billion, the Sochi Olympics have cost the same amount as 20 Mars rover exploration missions. About 80% of the world's heroin is produced in the country where the U.S. has fought its longest war, Afghanistan. The drug trade, once nearly eradicated by the Taliban, is worth about $3 billion a year to the impoverished country, or roughly 15% of its GDP. And we'll finish with a quote from Eleanor Roosevelt. No one can make you feel inferior without your consent. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward. I hope you've enjoyed it. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.